Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
And now, hammer in hand at a Habitat for Humanity worksite this morning, President Bush told NBC's Today show that he senses a revival in the hurricane-ravaged Gulf region, and he doesn't think that the federal government should come up with a master plan for reconstruction.
I don't think Washington ought to dictate to New Orleans how to rebuild.
Meanwhile, on the CBS Early Show, Kevin Davis, president of Louisiana's St. Tammany Parish, agreed that progress is being made, but housing for hurricane victims is still a big problem.
To give you an idea, 104,000 people registered with FEMA of our citizens from St. Tammany alone. 45,000 of those could qualify for a temporary housing.
More than 500,000 people are still in shelters and hotels, but the president has set October 15th as the deadline for evacuees to move out of shelters. And FEMA is also debating stopping reimbursements to the Red Cross for hotel rooms next week. So where will these people go? First, a quick check-in with Don Schwab. He's president of Louisiana's Terrebonne Parish. Don, how many people are still in shelters or need housing where you are?
We have approximately about 200, maybe in excess of about 200 people still in the Civic Center shelter here in Houma, Louisiana.
That's been several weeks. Are you hearing any answers from FEMA as to what to do about housing them?
No, we haven't. We had a task force down here approximately 2 to 3 weeks ago. They was going to try to pinpoint and earmark some property. But you have to understand, Robin, that you know the Intercoastal Canal kind of splits Houma in half, south and north, and everything south of the Intercoastal is almost in flood zone, so I don't see them putting trailers south of the Intercoastal.
I want to ask you, Don, other people in other areas are saying that there are plenty of empty apartments that aren't being used. Do you have that in your area?
No, ma'am, we don't. Every apartment complex, matter of fact, we just had three new apartment complexes that were finished probably about 6 months before Katrina hit. And every apartment complex in town is full with a waiting list.
Okay, so you're all full up there.
Yes, ma'am.
Don Schwab in Louisiana's Terrebonne Parish. Don, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And good luck to you.
Yes, ma'am.
Well, we turn now to Dr. Ronald Utt. He's a housing expert at the Conservative Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. And Dr. Utt, it does seem impossible that people are going to have places to go by next week's deadline to get out of shelters and possibly hotels. Fewer than 8,000 have found temporary housing through FEMA out of the thousands that need it. So do you think, is this understandable because of the extraordinary circumstances or is something else going on?
No, it's actually baffling because many have urged the administration, and we thought the administration and FEMA have endorsed this, to take advantage of all the vacant apartment rental units available in the southeast of the United States or any place in the United States as a good source of temporary housing until people can move back.
Well, let's remind people, there are voucher programs. There's a Section 8 program that offers help for poor people with housing that's in place in the federal government. And there are also emergency vouchers that can be issued. They have been in the past. Why do you think FEMA and the feds are not taking advantage of that?
Well, they say they are, but then they 2 days or 3 days later, they come out and tell us that they have 116,000 trailers on order and hope that they'll all be available at some point during the year. Well, 116,000 trailers is probably close to the manufacturing capacity on a yearly basis. So these things are going to dribble in very slowly, one at a time. They have to be hauled from the factory. They have to be put someplace, and utilities have to be hooked up to them. It's a very cumbersome and costly and duplicative process, particularly when you have, in the southeast United States, over 1 million rental apartment units that are available for $700 a month or less.
I was amazed at the numbers at 50,000 in Houston, 80,000 in another Texas city.
We have the highest vacancy rate in history right now.
Well, Dr. Utt, you've been quoted as saying not only has this been mismanaged, but at some point it goes beyond incompetence. It almost seems to be willful. What do you mean?
Well, there's always the question of, is this a deliberate effort to require the residents of Louisiana, Mississippi, and Alabama who are going to receive federal help to return to their states? There's been a lot of concern and a lot of discussion as to whether a lot of these people who had lives of you know, typical low-income person in a high-crime area who may find someplace else attractive and simply choose not to move back.
Well, that might be the fear of especially Louisiana officials who don't want their state to empty out. But as you well know, critics on both the left and the right are wondering if this White House in particular does not want to expand federal government programs, including voucher programs.
Well, they will be then in their place creating a federal trailer program. Because it's not going to save any money by not using vouchers.
Well, Dr. Ott, given that you're opposed to the trailers, and so far the government doesn't seem to be willing to take up the this apartment situation, what do you think should be done?
Well, I think many of us are still hammering away at both FEMA and the White House for a clarification of what their policy is, criticizing them where criticism is earned and merited and where a change might occur. And we've seen last week that Congress has finally caved in on Operation Offset and are going to cut spending to help pay for the relief effort. And I think there's hope that we can get a turnaround in the housing policy.
Dr. Ronald Ott, housing expert at the Heritage Foundation in Washington, D.C. Dr. Ott, thanks for speaking with us.
You're quite welcome.
Well, this Saturday, October 15th, another deadline looms large. Iraqis are scheduled to go to the polls to vote on a new constitution. A draft charter was sent out several weeks ago, and negotiations continue between Sunni leaders, who aren't happy with the document, and Shiite and Kurdish leaders who are pressing for its passage. Today in Iraq, two suicide car bombs killed at least 40 Iraqis in separate attacks. And this morning, President Bush said he expects more violence before Saturday's vote, but he expressed optimism that Iraqis would brave the attacks to cast their ballots. Will they? We begin an extended look at the state of Iraq, first with Dan Murphy, reporter for the Christian Science Monitor. He joins us now from Baghdad. Dan, welcome.
Thanks.
And we're hearing this news today that you're well aware of, the car bombings in Baghdad and in the northwest town of Tal Afar, the site of that major offensive against militants last month, and U.S. officials predicting more in advance of Saturday's election. So what do you think? Are people there prepared to vote? Will they turn out to vote?
It depends where you are in the country. Certainly many millions of Iraqis are going to vote, and in the Shiite south and in the Kurdish far north, I think we'll probably see very high turnout again in contested and violent areas. This has been going on for a long time now. We're going to see very low turnout. What that number is going to be, who can say? But the question in Iraq really isn't whether or not people turn out to vote. It's if the act of voting actually does something to end the war. And that seems very unlikely at best.
Well, let's talk more about the reason for voting, the Constitution. What are Sunni leaders asking for, and are they likely to get it?
At this point, I don't know. There were some negotiations today, and I don't know what was said at that particular meeting. But in general, Sunni leaders do not like the notion of a federal Iraq. While it's not well defined in this draft constitution, to them it looks a lot like the first step towards breaking up the state, or at the very least, having wealthy Kurdish area in the north of the country, a wealthy Shiite area in the south of the country, because there's oil more or less in both places. And in the Sunni center of the country, there's no oil. So they see themselves ending up with a rump Iraq with no political influence and less money. So they don't like it. Nothing is going to be reached that is going to satisfy Sunnis between now and then. These negotiations are mostly window dressing. And if there are any changes that are made, it's hard to imagine how they'll be able to get that information out to the Iraqi public at large, since the vast majority of Iraqis haven't even read the draft that they were told was the final draft about a month ago.
Right. We saw pictures of old drafts being thrown out. Well, what are Sunni leaders doing? Are they encouraging, going back to the turnout, are they encouraging Sunnis to go out and vote it down, or is it thought that there's no way they could anyway? Do they have the numbers to vote it down?
In answer to the first question, they're a bit split. Some are saying, let's boycott the whole thing because we're getting railroaded, and anything that we do to participate legitimizes it. But I think that, if we can speak for the community as a whole, there's a much greater movement to get out and vote this time and to vote it down, or to at least make a strong showing of how unhappy they are, so that the Sunni political representatives can say, yes, in fact, what we're telling you is true. We have lots of people behind us. Do they have the ability to vote it down? The short answer is no. The structure of this election and the demographics of Iraq mean that Shiite and Kurdish enthusiasm for this document ensures its passage.
Yeah, and you have said to us that if the Sunnis could reject it, which they probably don't have the numbers to do it, it wouldn't be such a bad thing. What do you mean by that?
I mean, to my way of thinking, what this Constitution is doing, rather than serving as a national compact that can bring Iraqis closer together, it's driving them further apart. It is viewed as a guy said to me today, it's both an American and an Iranian-sponsored document. From the Sunni community, they see it as imposed for outside. It's terrible for them. And if you have Sunnis overwhelmingly turn out against this document, but then still have it pass over their heads, that sends the message that the political process has nothing to offer them the way it's been set up, that their only hope is through the gun. I would have liked to see this be dragged out for a much longer period of time until hopefully a real national compromise could have been reached, because of the way the deadlines were set by the United States and by some of the Shiite leaders involved on this end, that time wasn't allowed. And who knows how much time would be enough time anyways, but it clearly wasn't enough in this circumstance. And we have a very flawed document that is not going to do anything to stop the violence and has a good chance of deepening the nascent civil war we're living in here.
You refer to it as a civil war. Dan Murphy, Middle East correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor. Dan, thank you.
Thank you.
Dan speaking to us from Baghdad, and we're now joined on the line by Pam Hess, Pentagon reporter for UPI, United Press International. She's just back from 9 weeks in Iraq. Pam, you heard Dan say that most of the Iraqis he met see this as a constitution imposed by both the U.S. and Iranians. What are you hearing from Iraqis?
From Sunnis, there is a real concern about the Iranian influence. I was in a Sunni household just a week ago, and people who spoke English and actually were quite pro-American. And I asked, what do you think is going on, and what do you think about? I know you're pro-American military. What do you think about the Iraqi military? And this girl who's in college, 22, speaks English, is internet savvy, said, "Well, of course they're all Iranian." And I said, the Iraqi military is all Iranian. And she said, yes. And I asked her if she was going to be voting in the constitutional referendum. And again, this is a college student, internet savvy, and pro-U.S. And she said, what constitutional referendum? She was unaware of it. On the same block, some guy just right down the street, he's the product of Sunni and Shia marriage, and he said it was very important to get out and vote. He was going to vote for it. Then around the corner, I ran into a Sunni merchant who was very erudite, and his take on it, he's quite anti-U.S., and his take on the Constitution was that no matter how it turned out, no matter how the vote turned out, if the Sunnis felt like the voting was fair, they would be for it. Now, this is a guy that, during the course of the conversation, sort of spun into rhetoric that one would expect to hear from insurgents about how it's his responsibility to kill all Americans. Anyone that kills a Muslim must be killed, and it didn't matter if he would lose his life in the process. So here was someone that was coming at it from quite a strong point of view, but said as long as it was perceived as fair, that the country would move on.
Pam Hess is a Pentagon correspondent for UPI. Well, Pam, obviously you've got wonderful anecdotes to share with us about the people you've met over 9 weeks, 2 months spent in Iraq. Tell you what, let's take a break because we want to hear more of these stories, the words of Iraqis about the upcoming election when we come back. Much more ahead here and now. And now, and we're back with Pam Hess, Pentagon reporter for UPI. She's back from 9 weeks traveling across Iraq, meeting with U.S. troops, Iraqi battalions, and average Iraqi citizens. And Pam, you were just sharing some stories, but I just want to touch on something that Dan Murphy of the Christian Science Monitor just said. He said he didn't think it would be such a bad thing if the Constitution failed in the deadline voting this Saturday. He doesn't think it will because the Sunnis don't have the numbers, but how do you feel about that assessment?
I think it would actually be the best thing if this constitution failed, because it would give the Sunnis a sense that they have a way of protest that is not violent. They can have an effect on the government. But that failure would then have to be followed up with Shiites and Kurds responding very maturely and making changes, bringing the Sunnis into the process, making changes to the next round of constitution that would come out in order to come up with a document that people can actually feel good about and can support and set up a government that has legitimacy.
Well, let's review how hard that might be. I mean, the Sunnis, again, to remind us, were part of the ruling minority under Saddam Hussein and didn't show up for the elections. So, you know, how hard is that going to be for, as you said, the Shiites and Kurds to act maturely?
I think that actually this time I disagree with Dan. I think that there's going to be big Sunni turnout in all the places that I was in, and I spent a great deal of time in the Sunni provinces. They are signing up in droves, and they've been getting sort of mixed messages. The latest message is I think, from the Zarqawi crew saying, don't show up, there's going to be violence. But all along...
Zarqawi, of course, Al-Qaeda in Iraq.
Right. Mm-hmm. All across Iraq, there have been Sunni imams and Sunni leaders saying, definitely, you have to vote. We saw the mistake that we made by not voting the first time. They've come up with this government and with this document that doesn't serve our needs, so now we have to get out and show our numbers. As for the Shiites and the Kurds responding maturely, I don't know. I think that the Shiites have shown an enormous amount of restraint in not responding to the provocations of Sunni insurgents and Zarqawi's terrorist attacks, which are largely focused on Shiites. The Kurds, I think, are sort of sitting the fence. They have a really good thing going up there. After 12 years of being protected from Saddam Hussein, they set up an autonomous government. They have their own military forces that are quite good. They actually are in the area where there is oil. So I think they feel like they have a way out if the country falls into civil war. I don't agree with his assessment that there is civil war right now. I think that's way too strong.
Well, and so you're going with that it's an insurgency. And we're hearing, and in fact you quote in some of your writing, Lieutenant Colonel Bradley Becker of the 2nd Battalion of the 8th Field Artillery Regiment, who says that anyone who comes to a counterinsurgency thinking it's about killing terrorists is missing the boat. Is there a new sense of how to fight the insurgents?
It's not new, but it's something that that is really taking root in the military, and it's this. It's something that they have actually realized and been doing for quite a while, and they're beginning to see results, and that is all that you can do in a counterinsurgency as a military person is keep a lid on the violence. You can't possibly stop the car bombers except through long, hard intelligence work, but there will always be more people coming in willing to do that. You can't possibly kill all of the bad guys because you can't find them, and you wouldn't want to kill them. There are many people who are being paid simply to set IEDs because there are no jobs, so therefore they're taking $100 because that will feed their family for 2 months. So do you want to kill that guy? No. What you want to do is get him a job and win him over to the side that you're fighting for. So the military has this sort of a broad approach where they're doing, you know, very aggressive operations when they can get actionable intelligence and to scoop up bad guys, but spending, you know, a lot of their time doing reconstruction work, working with provincial councils, trying to get local government up and working, and very heavily working with Iraqi security forces, trying to get them standing up on their own.
Right, but as we know, Iraqi troops are not ready to take over, and we're hearing also from military leaders in Iraq at the beginning of this month saying publicly that the troops that are in Iraq, the U.S. troops, are fueling the insurgency, which seems like a real shift. What are you hearing from soldiers you're meeting in the field? Are they feeling that, which, you know, many critics of the administration policy of keeping a large number of troops in Iraq would say the same thing?
Yeah, it's a really sort of weird mixed bag and a catch-22. In places where there are not large numbers of U.S. troops, you have these pockets of very strong insurgent cells, people that are sort of doing all kinds of violence and causing all kinds of trouble. But then in places where you have a lot of U.S. forces, they're an annoyance. They make the people feel as though they are being occupied, and then the law-abiding people will sort of turn their heads when, you know, one in their number sets an IED, because they think, well, you know, these guys are occupiers and they're legitimate military targets, so let's let them go. So there's this weird balance that has to be kept between when are you helping and when are you actually hurting. And it's not fair to make a sweeping statement about the entire country. Each province, even each town, is different, and there are places where the Iraqi security forces are in the lead and are maintaining security, and U.S. forces are sort of sitting back, and the support that they're giving to them is mostly logistical.
Pam Hess, sorry about that. I just want to, in the minute we have, I want to ask you, because we began with a conversation with Dan Murphy from the Christian Science Monitor as well, talking about Saturday's election referendum on the Constitution, and both of you said that you felt that if the Sunnis could overturn the Constitution, it might not be a bad thing, and there might actually be some peace, some demonstration that politics can work. But if, in fact, the Constitution is accepted, what happens then? Because, as you've said, the Sunni insurgency, the Sunnis back the insurgency. What do you expect to happen if the Constitution passes?
If the Constitution passes, I'm not sure what the near-term reverberations are, but what the long-term thinking is on this, the reason why they are pushing ahead with this, is that getting a government that people actually vote for, as opposed to a government that's installed by the United States or is a product of a flawed vote, which this January vote was because the Sunnis didn't participate, getting a government that people vote for will do something to establish legitimacy and to get public support going for Baghdad. That's really what they want. So even though these components leading up to that are deeply flawed, and they are, the U.S. government in Baghdad is banking on the fact or gambling that just having another popular vote and establishing a new Iraqi government will go a long way towards pulling out a lot of the venom from the Sunni insurgents. I've learned long ago not to make predictions about Iraq. That place can change on a dime. We all expected tremendous violence in the election in January, and in fact, it was the exact opposite.
Pam Hess, UPI's Pentagon correspondent, just back from 9 weeks in Iraq. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Much more ahead, here and now. Funding for Here and Now. Today, Liberia, the country founded by liberated U.S. slaves, is holding its first presidential election since the end of a brutal 14-year civil war. Voters began lining up to cast their ballots as early as 2 a.m. to choose from 22 candidates, including a former international soccer star and a Harvard-educated businesswoman. Freelance reporter Ken Schulman is covering the elections. He joins us on the line from the streets of the capital city of Monrovia. Ken, how do things look at the polls so far?
People are incredibly tranquil and incredibly enthusiastic at the same time. I've traveled across various provinces and spent a lot of time in Monrovia. I did not meet one person who said he or she had not registered to vote. I did not meet one person who was not planning to vote. I was out this morning at 3:30 in the morning going all across voting sites in Monrovia. There were already lines that were 100 to 150 meters long. People were waiting, knowing that they would be there all day. They were very happy and very anxious to express their vote. It's moving, Robin. I didn't expect to be moved like this, and I was. These people have suffered so much. They have virtually no reason to believe that their lives will be better, yet they believe in democracy. They believe that by casting their votes, they can make a difference.
That's in Monrovia, but what about some of these polling places outside of the capital city? We understand some are in mud-soaked forests, several days' walk, no electricity in most of the country. How are they handling this?
A lot of the polling places are in IDP camps, internally displaced persons camps. Some of them are in huts. Some of them are in abandoned schools. If there were 400 registered voters in that precinct, when I was there at 10 o'clock in the morning, there were 300 people waiting in line. My impression is that the turnout is going to be very impressive.
And they're busing people, we understand?
There are many people who took refuge either in IDP camps or in the capital, Monrovia. They are being trucked out or bussed out or vanned out in vehicles that I would think twice about getting onto, but that are being transported back to their places of origin so they can cast their votes in their home communities.
Ken Schulman, this is a largely illiterate country. How are they voting?
With great patience. There is an electoral staff at each polling place that instructs each voter how to mark his or her ballot. Essentially, the ballots are marked by ink thumbprints. The electoral instructor gives the ballot to the voter. The instructor explains how to do it, inks the person's thumb. The person then goes into a cardboard booth where he or she recognizes the candidate he wants to vote for by a symbol, then indicates his preference and hands the vote back to the electoral instructor.
Past elections in Liberia, as we know, have been incredibly corrupt. This time around, there's 15,000 UN peacekeepers. There's also hundreds of international monitors, including former American President Jimmy Carter. Have you seen any signs of violence or corruption?
The presence of the 15,000 UN troops has been a godsend to this country, and the Liberians are extremely grateful. The UN has brought peace to a land that has been racked by war for over 15 years. I spoke with former President Carter this morning at a elementary school just outside Monrovia, where he was observing the balloting. He said that he had seen no signs of electoral irregularity, that he was very pleased by the turnout, by the conduct of the voters, and he had every reason to expect that the voting would be free and fair.
Well, Ken, what about concern about after the elections? One of the candidates is George Weah. His supporters call him King George, a 40-year-old former soccer star. He's had huge appeal among the 100,000 or so former child soldiers. They call him the Messiah. Is there concern that if he doesn't win, these young people who have invested so much in him will revert to some of the violence they showed in the past?
Precisely, Robin. That is my concern. I met with some of the former rebels. They now are peaceful. A lot of them are sort of given concessions to cut timber or to collect rubber from the abandoned rubber plantations. The interim government has given them these concessions to keep the warriors peaceful and to give them a way to make a living so they won't cause trouble. The people I spoke with said that they're, for the most part, supporting George Weah. Weah has enormous, enormous appeal to the youth because of his prominence as a soccer star. He's also, and this is not his fault, but he's also become sort of a standard bearer for ignorance and anti-education. There's a very strong backlash against educated politicians, against the entire ruling class here, because it's so badly failed these people. And this is a very dangerous moment for Liberia. The people have suffered. They're having 2 years of relative peace and relative tranquility, but the economy is in a shambles. 85% of the country is unemployed. There's no electricity. There's no running water. Should George Weah not be able to deliver on his promises after election, I believe the country could very easily descend into violence.
The anti-education campaign can't bode well for the other frontrunner, Ellen Johnson Sirleaf, who was educated at Harvard.
That's correct. Her candidacy and Weah's candidacy sort of illustrate how the country is polarized. It's polarized between people who favor education, who favor a leader who will be able to represent the country in institutions like the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the UN, and people whose lives have essentially been snuffed out and robbed by the war, who have been deceived and deluded by politicians who have essentially worked just to loot and line their own pockets.
There was a lot of concern that Charles Taylor, the former leader who was forced out in March of 2003 and has been indicted for war crimes, charges of stoking civil war in Sierra Leone. He's in exile in Nigeria, but there's talk that he's going to try to influence this election. Can you see any of that?
For the most part, people agree that Taylor has tried to meddle in these elections, that he is channeling money towards certain candidates. Those who fear Taylor most believe that Taylor has a strategy of planting his people in other parties where they will seek election, either in the lower house or in the Senate. There is a chance that an elected Liberian president will ask Nigeria for Taylor's extradition. In that case, Taylor has every interest in having a parliament that is favorable towards him so he won't be indicted, or should he be indicted, that he might get a break from the court.
Ken Shulman is covering the elections in Liberia today. He's speaking to us from the capital of Monrovia. Ken, thanks very much.
You're very welcome, Robin.
And in other news today, the man seen being repeatedly beaten by two New Orleans police in a news videotape is speaking out. 64-year-old Robert Davis says he had returned to New Orleans to inspect his family property when he had a violent encounter with police.
Bam! I got hit, and that was all I remember other than trying to block the blows. At no point during this altercation did they say that I was under arrest or anything. They didn't read my rights, anything.
The police officers, three of whom were white, had accused Davis, who is black, of public intoxication. But the retired school teacher says he hasn't had a drink in 25 years. The two city police officers accused in the beating and a third accused of grabbing and shoving an Associated Press television news producer have pleaded not guilty to battery charges. They've been suspended without pay from the police force. Meanwhile, the U.S. Justice Department has opened a civil rights investigation to see if race was a factor in the incident. You're listening to Here and Now. always, we welcome your thoughts on anything on our program. Send us an email at letters@here-now.org. That's letters at here-now.org. Or you can call our listener line and leave a message, 617-358-0397, 617-358-0397. Please tell us how to pronounce your full name and the town you're from. Stay with us. More ahead here and now. Well, every year for the past 150 years, right before Lent, revelers have taken to the streets of New Orleans for Mardi Gras, a wild week of parades and parties and drinking, which traditionally draws about 1 million tourists and brings in a staggering $1 billion in revenue. This year, with barely a quarter of the city up and running, with the lion's share of hotel rooms being used by federal emergency workers, and with much of the city's population worrying about finding housing, many are asking whether it's feasible or appropriate to go on with the show. For others, the question isn't whether to hold Mardi Gras, but how. Among them is the owner of the float-making empire known as Mardi Gras World, Blaine Kern. Blaine, welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Robin.
Now, you've been involved in the annual pre-Lenten party and parade for more than 50 years.
58, darling,
oh,
and
boy.
Counting.
Okay, don't take those 8 away. Well, do you think this is going to be the 59th?
Not only the 59th for me, but the 150th, where it's a formal Mardi Gras celebration.
Well, and New Orleans has been underwater of late. You really think that this is going to, Mardi Gras really is going to take place this year?
Darling, I know it's going to take place. They called me, as I told you, Mr. Mardi Gras.
Mm-hmm.
And I got on phone last week with the conference call with the head of the convention center, Jimmy Four, here, with the captains of Bacchus, Orpheus, Rex, Endymion, Zulu.
And I got to stop you there. These are crews. These are some of the different groups.
These are the crews, yeah, but they're the major crews. It's K-R-E-W-E, spelled in the old English banner, with a captain in front, a carnival club. There's all sorts of things.
I know. It's a huge culture. All these, as you said, all these groups of people working in their dens, building the floats. Do you even have the people to put on the parade?
Oh, yeah. Well, we're down right now. We're about half as many people, but I have artisans and sculptors and artists and people who are specialists in doing the papier-mâché, gold and silver leaf. They're all coming back. I've been in contact with them, and some of them lost their homes and lost everything. I live in Algiers, which is a suburb of New Orleans, but we're blessed. It was dry over here, but at the Rex Den, we had 6 feet of water in the Rex Den, and even found a dead man up in the den. We don't know how he got in, but I think he sought refuge when one of the doors was blown off. And over here in the West Bank, I had 2 buildings. The ceilings and roofs fell on top of tractors and floats. I have tractors about with big generators on each tractor that supplies the pulling power and the energy that lights up the floats. We are coming back strong.
Well, but you're making my points for me. I mean, half your people aren't back yet. And what about tourists? I mean, we understand that the FEMA, for instance, has contracted for 750 of the 1,100 hotel rooms in the Sheraton way past Mardi Gras. So where would the people stay?
But I'll give you an idea. They're giving up on some of those rooms. In fact, we're having a party. We'll make rooms somewhere, but I'd like to put them up in the various and different parades. Mm-hmm. Also, anybody listening, come join. These are mystical societies, Robin. You can't join. You have to be asked to join. And there's no advertisement at all on any of the Mardi Gras activities. In fact, if they catch you throwing advertisement, a book match, even from a restaurant, they throw you out of the club.
Mm-hmm.
And if you take your mask off riding down the street, they throw you out of the club.
Huh.
But this year they're going to need some riders, so anybody wants to come, I can't describe the experience to you.
Well, Blaine Kern, yeah. Mr. Mardi Gras,
yeah.
Has anybody been critical of the amount of money that would be spent to put on Mardi Gras when there's so much need?
But you see, let me explain to you. All of the parades are practically finished, and they're sitting, and it's a tremendous investment. But on top of that, it means so much. This is going to be like a coming-out party, Robin. Everybody wants to do it. It's actually ingrained into our society. I'm the captain of one of these groups. I get little girls' names when they're born. I got queens for my club for the year 2020-odd.
Mm.
And there's 5 or 6 friends of mine that are in my particular crew that they know that next year and the year after that they're going to be the king and their daughter's going to be the queen.
Yeah, you're saying that maybe the city can't afford not to do it.
They can't afford not to do it. I think that the city needs this. in other words, to express themselves. Mm. And everybody wants to do it, Robin.
Blaine Kern, Mr. Mardi Gras. He runs the float building company Mardi Gras World. Blaine, I wish you the best of luck.
Well, thank you, Robin, and call me back later on, sweet. I'd love to hear from you and bring you up to date, okay?
Okay, and I hope it's good news. Blaine, thank you.
Bye-bye.
My new best friend, Blaine Kern. Stay with us. Much more ahead, here and now. It's Here and Now. The writer Joyce Maynard became famously famous at a young age. At 18, her autobiographical essay in New York Times Sunday magazine catapulted her to the cover of the magazine. It also caught the eye of writer J.D. Salinger, who brought her to his home for a controversial December-May relationship. Well, Joyce Maynard went on to become an acclaimed author in her own right, and now with a number of books behind her, she's the mother of three grown children and has written her second novel for young adults. The Cloud Chamber is the story of a farm family unraveling in the wake of a tragedy. Perhaps the annual science fair will save them? Well, Joyce Maynard joins us now, not to give away the ending, but to tell us how this book began. Joyce, thanks so much for speaking with us.
Oh, it's always good to talk to you, Robin.
A cloud chamber and a cloud hanging over the Chance family. Let's start there. What is that cloud?
Well, the novel was inspired loosely by the experience of a dear friend of mine who came home from school one day when he was 13 years old to see police leading his father away in an ambulance with blood pouring down his head. His dad had attempted suicide but not succeeded. And I used that hugely traumatic experience in the life of a young person as the origin of this work of fiction that explores not so much the question of suicide, but of family silences. You know, what my friend said of that experience, and it really resonated for me from my own life, was that the hardest part was that nobody talked about it.
The young boy who's your protagonist keeps trying to ask different people, the police, the farmhand, his mother, to talk about it. And it's just you want to jump in the pages of the book and say, talk to him. But
so,
people,
you know,
don't.
One theme I think that carries through all my work, both my writing for adults and now for young people, it is this question of silences and family silences that I consider just one of the most confusing and damaging things. And that comes very personally from my own experience of growing up in an alcoholic family where we never discussed what was going on.
An alcoholic family, was it a loving family?
A very loving family, and it was a hugely communicative family in every other way. My father got drunk every night. The other part was that in the daytime hours, we pretended it never happened.
Well, in your new book, the family pretends a father's attempted suicide never happened. So the young boy decides to enter the state science fair and build a cloud chamber. What are you saying about this fascinating thing? I mean, I was thrown right back into the science projects, you know, I did in grade school.
Did you enter science fair?
Oh, yes. The batteries.
I was never particularly a science person, but I loved building projects. It's a metaphor, of course, for some sort of magical thing that will solve the problem. To enter this science fair with the hope of winning the science fair, and for a set of sort of complicated reasons that I won't go into here, he believes that if he can win the science fair, he can get to his dad. But once again, I'm always in my books in one way or another. I remember very well the experience of trying to fix things by just being successful, making something happen that would make everybody happy and make the problems go away. The particular magic of the cloud chamber is that it's a box in which, here comes a very unscientific description, what is normally invisible can be seen, namely radioactively charged ions. And, of course, we're talking about invisible things here, and invisible sorrows and pains, and making them visible.
Well, we don't want to give away the ending, but suffice to say, it's not, how shall we say, the Rocky of science fairs. What are you trying to say about, you know, the best we can make of these situations?
Well, I would say really that the boy's redemption comes most closely in the form of taking control of his own life and feeling that he's not powerless anymore. There's something he can do. And I always look to action as the source of comfort, finding a way to involve oneself. Otherwise, you're swamped. Hmm.
Joyce Maynard, you set this story in the 60s, and we've talked about how you were, you know, this iconic image of teens when you were on the cover of the Sunday New York Times magazine. The little sister sings herself to sleep by singing Mrs. Brown, You've Got a Lovely Daughter. But I just want to ask you about that relationship between Nate and his little sister. It's so sweet. And often in a beleaguered family, the children can't be honest with each other. You know, almost turn on each other, competing for what little attention there is.
You know, I have a bit of a history, I guess, of putting my young characters in difficult situations. My novel before this one, The Usual Rules, involved a girl whose mother had been killed in the World Trade Towers. But if I'm going to do that to a young person, I want to also equip them with the best thing that I can imagine that they could have going for them, and that's a loving sibling.
Is that in part to make up for something you've spoken of, which is that you and your sister did not really know each other?
It is. I imagine, I go back to my childhood, and I imagine all the same circumstances, but if I'd been able to talk to my sister.
Yeah. You know, since we've got you on the couch, Joyce Maynard, I just want
to it's okay.
Well, I just want to get an update from you, because the last time we spoke is when you were writing very honestly about a relationship with J.D. Salinger, right? Yeah. After, you know, you were on the Sunday magazine. He was a much older man, and you know, a lot of people criticized you for telling the truth from your point of view about that relationship. Has that died down some, or what?
I have to say, in the last 2 days, I've been interviewed once by a Japanese journalist and once by a Spanish journalist still about this, Robin. And, you know, if I live another 50 years, probably, it will still be, you know, a circumstance that a piece of my experience. I'm 51 years old. I've done a lot of things in my life, but the fact that when I was 18 years old, I spent a year with this man who occupies the imagination of so many people, remains sort of, you know, the thing about me, I guess. And I'm not shy to discuss it. I'm certainly not ashamed to discuss it. I know it's not my whole story, but and I feel very comfortable that I wrote that book. I don't believe that it is the obligation of any of us to keep somebody else's secret for them. Of course, there are times when somebody confides in you and you keep their secret. But for a 53-year-old man to say to an 18-year-old girl, as was said to me, you must never speak of my role in your life, is not fair. You know, to keep the secrets. I mean, to not talk about somebody getting drunk or, you know, whatever it is that is somebody else's uncomfortable secret that we bear for them at the expense of our own ability to sort of live a less burdened life. And I was in my 40s before I recognized that I had no obligation to protect J.D. Salinger.
So we're back to the theme of keeping secrets, that which is at the heart of the Cloud Chamber. Has hell frozen over? Have you heard from Mr. Salinger?
Oh, no.
Okay.
I don't ever expect to do that. But the good news is I'm not waiting for the phone to ring. Once I did really live my life sort of, you know, thinking about what he would be thinking of me. And I don't worry about that anymore.
We're talking to Joyce Maynard, her new book, The Cloud Chamber, the story of a farm family after the tragedy of a father who shoots himself. Joyce, thanks so much for speaking with us. We appreciate it.
Good talking to you too, Robin.
Here Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Robin Young. Please join us again here and now.
funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.
PRI, Public Radio International.
I'm Robin Young.